Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner, right here on The Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We are going back 11 years. Listen to a conversation I had with academic, author, radio host, Michael Eric Dyson. We were talking about his book that had been published that year called Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster, which tells the stories of those who were left behind despite the relief efforts. He explains how Katrina wasn't just an engineering catastrophe, but exposed the complexities that still exist within race and class relations in America, all focused through New Orleans and Louisiana. These issues are still with us today, rearing their ugly head in American politics and throughout society. Looking back at previous failures to aid poor folks and Black Americans can be a way to find better methods for our future. So, I hope you enjoy this. It was an incredibly fascinating conversation. We learned from it then. We can learn from it now. Enjoy. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. I'm pleased to say that my guest, joining us once again, is Michael Eric Dyson, who is the Avalon Professor of Humanities at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. His latest book is Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster, among the many books he's written. This is his latest. And Michael Eric Dyson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. That's good.
Very good. It's always good to be on your show, and thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and it's always good when technology works.
Exactly.
So let me begin with this book again. It's Michael Eric Dyson, once again, as our guest, the Avalon Professor of History in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania. The latest book, Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. There's always this huge controversies, obviously, around what happened with Hurricane Katrina. We've done a number of shows about it with many people from New Orleans and people around the country. And there is this divide about what people think happened there. And some people, I think, let's just get right to the heart of what you're talking about, at least part of what you're talking about.
Right.
Which has to do with what you perceive as a lack of response over issues because the majority of people in New Orleans are poor and Black.
Well, that's certainly part of it. And
part
it's also
of it.
Because the government is ineffective, they had no experience, they were ignorant, and it's a governmental philosophy that believes in limited governance. So when you put all that stuff on the table, along with the issues of race and class, you've got a toxic stew that was boiling long before the vicious winds and violent waters of Hurricane Katrina were visited with lethal ferocity on the people of New Orleans and indeed the Gulf Coast. So yeah, I think that obviously, when we talk about race, I'm not talking about racism in as much as people had a negative or bigoted response to African-American people, though some of that did occur. I'm speaking primarily about the collective cues and the culture, the collective racial unconscious, that system and stream of ideas and events that shapes our perception of who is likely to be seen as worthy of effective and immediate response, and those who can be further down the food chain, so to speak. So when you speak about race, you're speaking about the collective understanding of people about the issues and identities of people of color. We're speaking about the divide between Black and white and many, many other ethnicities and races. We're also speaking about how those people who are poor and Black occupy a certain space in the collective American imagination. That's what I mean by race. I don't mean that there was the KKK conspiracy to put down Black people. I'm saying that when many of the people in the federal government looked out on that television screen or heard about the people who were there, they didn't have a gut instinct and a reaction that was deeply and profoundly intimate or empathetic, because these are people they didn't know or particularly care about. In as much as many Americans don't, they're poor, they're Black, they're not vote rich for the Republicans, they're not in a swing state during a election season. Their mothers and fathers didn't look like they were stranded there. Many of the people who were begging for help on television were obviously Black. And I think when you add class to that, that they were poor Blacks, 134,000 people in New Orleans didn't have access to cars. They weren't stubborn and stupid. They were demobilized by a lack of access to transportation. When you put all that stuff together, that infrastructure of sentiment and passion, collective unconscious, racial cues, that's what I'm talking about. Senator Barack Obama said, look, I didn't see any racism involved. I saw instead, he said, I think the incapacity and incompetence of the government, which was colorblind. Well, I think that what Barack Obama meant and what I'll take as his meaning he said there wasn't active malice, there was passive indifference. Well, I think that those are flip sides of the same coin. Active malice is the ring volume on the cell phone up high. Passive indifference is the ring tone on vibrate, but a message is still being communicated, an intention is still being transmitted. And I think when we look at all of that together, I absolutely believe that race, how could it not help but color the response to Hurricane Katrina and how we got resources there or failed to do so in a timely fashion.
I mean, but race in America fuels a lot about our country. And when you look at New Orleans as specifically, just your thoughts on this. I mean, there's of some of the mythology about what happened there and the reality of what happened there. That inside, as you write about in your book, inside of the African American community, there was among certain members of the African American community, there was a rumor and a mythology being built up that the levees had been blown up.
Right.
That occurred there. I mean, when you look at people saying that it was all black folks were dying, when 41% of the people who died in New Orleans were white, which is a huge number given what most people would think in terms of a kind of that. And then you have all the kind of total kind of lies that we talked about here on the show right after Katrina about the Astrodome and rapes and murders that never took place. But all those together,
exactly.
I mean, constitute a mythology that we built up around New Orleans that for some people is reality.
Oh, absolutely right. Well, taking them in order, the rumors and the conspiracy theories, so to speak, are the attempt of everyday people to leverage the power that they have to defend their lives. I mean, the point of the rumors, the point of the conspiracy theory, whether the craters are 25 feet deep at the bottom of the levees were put there because of dynamiting of those levees. It may not be necessarily physically true, but it could be metaphysically true. It could be spiritually true. It could be morally and even more important, politically true. Because the point of those conspiracy theory, especially rumors among poor people, is an attempt of everyday people to, you know, put their two cents into the argument. They interrupt power through rumor and conspiracy theory because when it generates, it spreads like a wildfire. It metastasizes across the cultural landscape. The collective awareness of American society and our imagination is stoked with these tidbits. They're titillating. They're frustrating. You can't put your finger on where they came from, and yet they exist. And that's the way everyday people without power or access to the media spread their message and get home a literal, or at least in their cases, not a literal, but a kind of metaphysical and even a moral truth. And the moral truth is this. What you're saying when you say that those levees were blown up deliberately, whether you can prove that or not, whether it's even true or not, what is true is the point they're trying to make, that poor black life is not considered to be equal to white life in America, or the fact that poor people are at the bottom of the totem pole suggests that their lives are vulnerable. That what you're saying is that, look, by saying that they might have blown up these levees to flood black communities, which, by the way, happened in 1927, we don't want to pretend that black people invented this whole cloth, the ones who subscribe to this conspiracy theory. But when we look at the most sophisticated analyses of rumors and conspiracy theories, it's grassroots judgment rendered by vulnerable people in defense of their lives that don't get much visibility or a greater hearing. So I think that's what's involved there. Whether it's true or not, it is spiritually true that the lives of poor black people just don't count as much, and that's what the point of the rumors are. In terms of the differential in deaths, 40-some percent of people who died, whose bodies we recovered, turn out to be white, and 47% turn out to be African-American, or maybe a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting there, 47% and 49% respectively, white and black. But what's interesting there, of course, is that there are so many more bodies that weren't discovered. There are so many more people who are dead who we will never know, whose identities we can never determine. But it does suggest, however, that many white people died in this storm. And I think that no good-thinking, right-thinking American or even a citizen of the world would deny that the storm itself was colorblind. It hit many areas, rich and poor. But what's interesting is that the after effects of the storm are hardly equal. The recovery efforts belie the notion that we're all equal, even in death. The reality is that the recovery efforts prove that African-American people lived in the most vulnerable parts of New Orleans, that the higher ground was occupied by people with more money and people who were predominantly white. It also is the case that the people who were in the lower-lying regions that were more vulnerable in the floodplain happened to be disproportionately African-American, and that the efforts to reach out to those people is not the same. I was down there less than 2 weeks ago, And what's interesting is that the electricity is not on, the schools are not running well. Some of the collar counties, what we know as parishes there, that are predominantly white, have been restored to their demographic integrity before the storm. New Orleans, however, is richer in the long run because the people who are able to return, by and large, are wealthier, upper middle class and middle class and the like. And it's whiter and it's shorn of poor people. And it's more conservative. So I think that, again, when we look at the impact of race in that level demographically, and this is why Ray Nagin's controversial statement about Chocolate City, well, if he's saying, look, we don't want any white folk coming back, that's ridiculous. I don't think that's what he meant, even though I have many critiques of Ray Nagin. I think what he was trying to do is to acknowledge that New Orleans had not paid attention to how African-American people should be brought back and repopulated in that arena that is environmentally devastated, that has toxic implications all over the place, and that is going apace with a reconstruction industry that, as Naomi Klein said, is part of disaster capitalism. Predatory capitalists who come in and exploit the vulnerable position of people, and in this case, people of color who are in this particular area, and before we know it, they've made millions and millions of dollars off of that misery, and none of the people who are there will be able to take advantage of it. And finally, in terms of the lies, yeah, they're lies, damn lies, and then there were the statistics, as Disraeli said, that were altogether distorted. The point is that, yeah, that stuff was mostly exaggerated. The media, which was praised for once again finding its spine, when Anderson Cooper debated Mary Landrieu and said, look, there are bodies here, don't congratulate yourself. When Soledad O'Brien on CNN said, look, to Michael Brown, what are you talking about? Even Ted Koppel got in there. What are you talking about? Don't you people watch television or read the news? We've been talking about this for more than 24 hours, this being the fact that there were people in the convention center who were poor.
Michael,
and, of course, all those bodies didn't pile up. That was all made up.
We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. Your thoughts from Michael Eric Dyson, his latest book, Coming Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster, and we'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. My guest this hour is Michael Eric Dyson. His latest work is Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. As we look at the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, what will happen to New Orleans, the issue of race and the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, what it says about the country at large, and how we deal with poverty in America. Your thoughts on that? Disagree or agree with the issues posited by Michael Eric Dyson? Michael, I'm sorry that I had to interrupt you in finishing a thought, I think you were.
Sure, yeah, and I'm sorry to say I've taken so long. I want to thoroughly address the point you
That's
made
okay.
briefly. The last point, of course, is that, yeah, there was a great deal of consternation generated as a result of media coverage that fit into a framework that pre-existed Katrina, that existed long before Katrina. That is a media-fueled, although not originated, set of stereotypes out there about black people that made it believable that they would engage in such nefarious and anarchic activity as was alleged. That is, that they were down there raping babies, that 200 bodies were buried beneath the convention center. Even Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans, and Eddie Compass, the former police chief, fueled these rumors when they said on Oprah as much. So the reality is that the media, on the one hand, found a spine, and at the other hand, it reinforced prevailing stereotypes about black behavior that made it believable that black people would have done the very things that they were claimed to have done but never did. And I think all of that bespeaks how race continues to make a huge difference in America, and certainly made a difference in Hurricane Katrina.
Well, just directly, I mean, do you think that, I mean, what played the greater role in your mind when it comes to the disaster relief effort that took place from FEMA? I mean, we're talking about, as you point out in your book, that most of the people managing FEMA have no history of managing emergencies.
Right.
They were just put in there as political appointees without thought about what these folks know or don't know about this kind of work.
Right.
I mean, was it, pardon me, was it that? Or do you think, I mean, do you really, that's really, I think, a real divide here in America. I mean, you point out the polls that say, 70% of African Americans think that the government would have responded sooner if the victims were white. The vast majority of white respondents, 75-77% or whatever that was, disagree and
right.
with that thing. So, I mean, there's always this different, you know, consciousness about those things in America, different perspectives, the different
right.
lenses of how we look at things because of race.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, do you think it was race with FEMA? Do you think it was just A, their incompetence, and B, the philosophy of this government, which is not preparing for those things in a hands-off kind of government.
Well, yeah, all that together. See, I think they're all intermingled. But here's the point. All that stuff exacerbates the underlying racial tensions that are there regardless. So I think that, you know, here's the thing. The divide in America that the poll showed that white folk believe one thing primarily, black folk believe another thing primarily, and the victims, overwhelmingly, the people who suffered, were African American. The people we saw on the television. And yes, in terms of even the deaths, we know that there was a greater equality in the found bodies. But the disproportionate effect and the impact on African-American people, I think, is undeniable. So what's interesting, the people who got hurt the most believe that their race played a role. The people who were less affected by it believe it didn't. That's not unpredictable. That's quite predictable. And it shows that if the pain is in your own body, you have a different sensibility and sensitivity than if you're describing somebody else's pain. A doctor who's dealing with a cancer patient feels one thing. That doctor has to deal with cancer, him or herself feels another. So I think that that has to be taken into account. But yes, I think incompetence by the government, a governmental philosophy of limited governance, the soft bigotry of low expectations, which the Bush administration has coined a phrase in reference to its attempt to challenge schools in inner cities that simply engage in social promotion without making or mandating those students be up to snuff, saw its own, if you will, mantra redound upon it negatively. They believed in the soft bigotry of low expectations because the people were political appointees, had no disaster mitigation or emergency management experience. So when you put that together with the race thing, yeah, it made a difference. But here's the point. I think that even if white folk were down there suffering primarily and not primarily black folk, it might have still been difficult for FEMA, given its ignorance and its, you know, in its governmental philosophy to get down there. But they would have tried, perhaps. And here's the difference. Again, if the gut instinct is generated out of somebody who looks like you, talks like you, whose experiences you know, after all, don't forget, when Mr. Bush went down to Mississippi, he was lamenting the loss of Trent Lott's house. Now, I'm not saying Trent Lott's house shouldn't be lamented or the loss of his property, but there are millions of people whose houses were lost. There are poor white people down there in Mississippi in particular, and African Americans as well, whose homes were lost forever, who don't have the wherewithal as Trent Lott does to rebuild. But Trent Lott is somebody he could identify with. He's in the Senate. He's a Republican. He's a prominent figure. You tend to get drawn to those people whose stories are most like yours. And the stories of those poor black people are not like the stories of white America by and large. And so let's not pretend if race already makes a huge difference in who is identified as worthy of consideration. After all, Natalie Holloway's mother has become very famous, Beth Holloway. And Natalie herself, bless her heart, who was lost in Aruba. But how many black girls have been lost without so much as a peep from the media? If you're a white woman, especially a blonde white woman, you have a higher priority in America. Now let's not pretend that's not the country we live in. And if we live in that country, why is it hard for us to acknowledge that poorer, blacker people who have no standing in American society and even in many African-American elite circles should be dismissed, ignored, or just don't count and register in the same way, and that the resources won't as quickly be marshaled in defense of their lives? When you add on that terrible government philosophy that is a child of Ronald Reagan and even before, that the government is the enemy of the people, and all the incompetence and cronyism that went up in the place, all that stuff made it an untenable situation even worse.
In the beginning of this, though, in the beginning of what happened, there's just two places here, and then we're going to open the phones. And Dee and Mike, you're the first two callers up. That on the one hand, in the beginning, it was Mayor Nagin and Governor Blanco, who and the George Bush administration, all of whom equally on different levels, didn't respond to this disaster either before or after it hit. I mean, before it hit, as you write again, Amtrak and others offered their help to get people out of New Orleans.
Absolutely.
Mayor Nagin didn't take them up on that.
Oh, man, it could have been saved hundreds of lives.
And there were could have been hundreds, if not thousands, of buses marshaled from around the state to go in there and pull poor people out of New Orleans and shift them to a higher ground. People could have been saved.
And not only that, Mayor Nagin was called at 6 p.m. on Saturday. Remember, the storm hit early Monday morning. and informed by the head of the National Weather Service. Look, sir, I'm calling at your home because I want to get this message to you. I want to have a clear conscience when I go to bed and save as many lives as possible. This storm is horrendous. It's the worst I've seen. Nagin said it scared the, quote, crap out of him, end of quote. But he didn't move until 10 o'clock the next morning to call a mandatory evacuation. Why? Because he consulted with the business community first. So even the interests of poor black people with a black mayor,
right,
by the way, who, you know, it was sided with Bush in 2000, crossed party lines to support Bobby Jindal, who is now the Republican congressman from that area, along with the fact that Mr. Nagin himself came from an elite corporate position as a cable company executive directly into the mayorship. So my point is that he wanted to consult the business community because he didn't want to be legally liable for calling a mandatory evacuation should they decide to sue him for losing business.
Wait,
so, I see. The rights of the citizens are not put forth. It is the rights of the business elites.
But is there a difference?
And that's a racial, that's a class element within African-American culture. That's why I said it's about race, it's about class, it's about poverty, and it's about all that stuff together exacerbating the condition of those who are vulnerable.
I mean, it's class. And once again, some people would argue that the issue here had more to do with, had as much to do with class as it did with race. I mean, there were tens of thousands of poor whites and Asians and Latinos who were stuck in that flood, not just African Americans. And in the beginning, FEMA didn't see the color of people. FEMA just didn't do anything. I mean, before they even saw the people who were standing on the roofs asking for, crying for help, hospitals full of people that no one evacuated. We talked to Bill Quigley, whose wife is a nurse in those hospitals. They stayed there to take care of people flooded and surrounded in the hospital by water. Surrounded by water in this hospital, but before that, before FEMA even saw the pictures, we saw the pictures of race and poverty in New Orleans. FEMA still didn't do anything. I mean, that's why I'm saying.
No.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, it seems
right, but it's not that they found out demographic statistics about New Orleans with Katrina. We already know that New Orleans is overwhelmingly black. You don't have to be. You live in America. You go to New Orleans. George Bush said he had been down there several times to have fun, maybe too much fun. So it's not.
Right.
And Louisiana is Democratic territory. So it's not simply about race at that level. But I'm saying let's not avoid the racial atmosphere, the racial reflex. Even before the pictures are seen, we know Gumbo Yaya. We know New Orleans. We know what's down there. That's not something that people discovered, that there were black people in New Orleans or that it was overwhelmingly black. That's a well-known fact. So we can't say, again, because there were white people down there who were part of the collateral damage, if you will. And I'm not reducing their roles to collateral damage because many white people were devastated by
right.
the storm
across
the Gulf region.
You just used the word, though. I mean
right. What I'm saying, collateral damage in terms of the racial politics of New Orleans. What I mean by collateral damage is that, let me put it this way. In my book, I quote Fitzhugh Brundage, who's a white historian. This is what he says about, and don't forget, this is a Southern racial narrative. Oklahoma-bred Michael Brown, Texas-bred George Bush, and all these black and poor and other white people and Latinos and Asians down there in the Gulf. This is a Southern racial narrative. This is what he says about race and the collective imagination of many white Southerners. Black pain or agency doesn't exist for the white imagination. We never acknowledge black pain or suffering or the possibility of positive agency being exercised within African-American communities. Now, I'm saying all of a sudden, we dismiss all the instincts we know about race, the bitter racial differences, the divides, the collective unconscious, the cues we get about who matters and whose lives make a difference. Can we dismiss all of that in the response? So we can't find a one-to-one correlation between, aha, they look down there and say, those are black folk, let's not do anything. No, that's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that the collective racial unconscious has already fueled our understanding of who is likely to be a recipient of help and who is not. And as a result of that exacerbated the condition that was already occurring, along with governmental incompetence, along with huge disappointment in a federal government that failed to respond, and the local government that fouled up as well.
Now, Michael, I do have to get the phones here, but one of the things that on this program, we've had a lot of shows about New Orleans since it happened, with people from there and from here. One of our guests frequently on the show is Ellis Marsalis III, whose family, obviously a very prominent New Orleans family.
Right.
One of the things he says, when you look at the newspapers, you saw pictures of poor black folks all through it. And you saw, and as you point out, there was those headlines about, you know, residents go to feed themselves from stores, and they happen to be white, and say youth who were looting stores were black. And that was just glaring in the headlines. But the other thing he said was left out was the fact was you saw no pictures, for some reason, of the thousands of Cajuns who were white, of the Vietnamese, who are the fishermen, who all live by the water, who all lived in lowland, who were all flooded out, and who were displaced in equal numbers. And what I'm saying is, when America sees what goes on there, if it is only defined by race, then America still doesn't see it.
You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com.
Good morning, this is Mark Steiner. Just a reminder that we are listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner.
Well, no, the Vietnamese shrimpers, 40,000 of whom were there.
Right.
The undocumented, some of the Mexican workers who were down there, 165 in the state altogether, 1,000, about 40,000 in that area displaced on farms. The Native American, 6 tribes.
Right.
That were in that Gulf Coast region from Alabama to Louisiana over to Mississippi. So, yeah, those ethnicities, which in a black-white paradigm always are obscured or undercounted, only reinforces the point of the utter invisibility of those people who suffered as well. So that, again, however, the racial divide is just now being expanded. That is, the ethnicities that count within this larger pool of racial animus suggest that there is a particular and specific fashion in which blackness signifies, however, in a quite altogether negative fashion. Because you weren't hearing stories about Mexicans messing up, Vietnamese people messing up. You were hearing stories about black people messing up.
Right.
So the framework within the media already accommodates a negative viewpoint disposed or predisposed toward African-American people that draws from the very collective racial unconscious about which I speak. The fact that the others don't exist or resonate there only reinforces the point of their utter invisibility and their marginality within that construct.
We're going to take some phone calls here as we talk with Michael Eric Dyson, who is the Avalon Professor of Humanities at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, a noted author and thinker in our country. His latest book is Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. And Dee, in East Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello?
Hi, Dee, you're on the air.
Yes, what I want to say is just two things. One, I'm very dubious, about Dr. Eric Dyson's, analysis based on his last book, attacking Bill Cosby, about saying the truth about inner city schools. But, about this new book, what I want to say is, we live in a sexist, racist society. What's new? Women don't have the same rights as men. Blacks don't have the same rights as whites. What's new? Is this book saying something that we should do different? Because, whenever, something like this happened, the O.J. Simpson case or, something happened and, everybody, want to, rehash something that everybody knows. So does his book address any way, how people can, help to, even, that gap? Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Well, you'll have to read the book and decide for yourself if it brings anything new. It's the first book out there, so hopefully it's new in that sense. It's new in the sense that you just heard the conversation between me and Mr. Steiner trying to give nuance, depth, complexity, and shade to an argument that we have some disagreement about in terms of the function and ferocity of race and the multiple levels at which it simultaneously operates that lead to contradiction and paradox. So there, again, it's not simple. It's simple to you, sir, or apparent to you that, black people don't count as much as white people or that women don't count as much as men. But yet we're having, an informed discussion about just how that plays out. So you may feel convinced in your own particular thinking, Brother D, but it may be a bit more complex. I'm going to talk about this in much more depth, or you can pick up the book and read it and then engage me further. But let me say this about Bill Cosby. The same black people who sided with Bill Cosby basically about saying that black people, and let me ask Dee, did you believe this? When Cosby said, pretty soon you're going to have a DNA card in the ghetto to determine if you're making love to your grandmother. She has a baby at 12. The baby has a baby at 13. The baby, you know, then the woman is 26 years old. You do the math, he said. I'm trying to keep you from having sex with your grandma. Now, if you think that that is attacking Bill Cosby as opposed to engaging him and asking him what he meant, then you probably have a negative viewpoint about African-American people who are poor, who should not be assaulted. But if you sided with Cosby, basically you believe that the black poor of New Orleans got what they deserved. So I do see this book as an extension of an argument I had begun in the Cosby book, because the question is not only does George Bush care about poor black people, the question is do African-Americans of wealth and standing care about poor black people? And I raise that question in the book as well.
We'll be right back. Michael Eric Dyson, Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. Jerry and Pikesville, you're the next caller up, and we'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. My guest this hour is Michael Eric Dyson. His latest work, Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. In a few minutes, we'll take a look at issues of how religion played into this and religious leaders and thought played into all of this, as well as this magic date of February the 7th that is about to approach, when many Katrina victims of Hurricane Katrina will be left out in the cold, literally. But let's go back to the phones as we get ready for that. Jerry in Pikesville, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jerry.
You know, we're a Christian nation, a Judeo-Christian nation. One of the principal platitudes that we love to repeat is, whatsoever ye do unto the least of these, ye do unto me. And the political leadership, over and over again, and Bush is a marvelous example. I think the basic message, and certainly blacks are the principal victims of this, but it's so much more important than even that. This society has contempt for the powerless, and West Virginia, the miners, who are white, I believe most of the victims were, the 14, were white Appalachians, very poor, proud. And the owner of the mine company came out and said, we couldn't get anybody at the Health, Mine, and Safety Organization for several hours. They had miserable equipment, even though the perils of the mine industry are well known. And 14 died, and there was brief recrimination and concern. It's the contempt for the powerless that Dr. Dyson ought to be promoting, because I think he gets more attention, though clearly blacks are the principal victims of that contempt for the powerless, and I'd like to hear his comments.
Thank you, Jerry. Michael?
Absolutely. You know, which is why I wrote a book about Bill Cosby's comments on the poor, who are predominantly, that he was speaking about, African-American, but who are absolutely voiceless and powerless within the hierarchy of American privilege. And I think that the call is absolutely right, that it is the contempt for the poor and the powerless in particular that resonates so arrogantly across the American media as well as politics, and that victimizes these folk. And then the Sago mine, as I pointed out on other programs, is episodic. We're interested. We report the man's condition, the one surviving miner, whether he came out of the coma or not. We're not interested in the underlying structural issues of inequality down there in West Virginia. We're not interested in the fact that these men go down into these mines and, you know, making relatively little money with little benefit, with black lung, with terrible health challenges. And we're concerned about them in passing, but not in a fundamental fashion. And he's right in terms of the, you know, in this case, African-American people being the major objects of this, but it's much broader, because what's interesting, even within whiteness, white poor people have the value of white skin privilege to call upon. I don't mean that because they're white, therefore they're rich. I'm saying that the benefit, the psychic and social benefit, when he said they were proud, the pride that they have resonates in their being identified as a part of an American mainstream, even if they're poor and being dismissed, whereas African-American people are demonized in a certain fundamental level, along with other others by the way. But there's no question that the contempt for the powerless and the assault upon those who are voiceless in America means we should band together and join together, overcoming the racism, the classism from within, so that we can generate forms of edifying solidarity. Amen to that, and right on.
Let's go back to the phone, Chair. I mean, I think that well, if I digress on this, we'd be here for days. But but the question of what you raise, white skin privilege, when it comes to people in Appalachia.
Oh, let me tell you what. Look, Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail with a poor white man, and he says, "Here you are, you have more in common with me than the white jailers." I'm saying white supremacy also thrives in West Virginia. And I'm saying white supremacy is the buying into the notion of the inherent superiority of one race and the inherent superiority to another. So a poor white person could believe they're actually superior to an African-American who might have a PhD from Princeton or Harvard or Yale, and that white person is stuck in Appalachia without much. That's what I'm talking about, the psychic investment in whiteness. If you read the works of David Roediger or Theodore Allen, if you read the works of the best of Tim Wise and some of the best writers on whiteness, Peggy McIntosh, you'll see that this area has been exploding for the last 10, 15 years about thinking critically about the function of whiteness and the self-destructive impulse of even poor whites to identify with a regime of white supremacy that undercuts them not only in terms of their identification with that whiteness, but cuts them off from other potential allies who could bind together in a form of solidarity. That's what I meant by
right.
privilege.
And I think maybe a discussion for another day might be, and if you'd come back, I think it'd be great to have, which has to do with almost like a contradiction in some sense what you're saying. I mean, you have this, what you said about Bill Cosby and what you said about certain members of the black upper middle class and
right.
and the African Americans who are in the mainstream of corporate culture of America.
Right, right. Their
sense of privilege and unity has to do with class and money less than it has to do with race.
Oh, absolutely. But that doesn't contradict the point I'm making. That's just edifying and adding another layer that I've already addressed. But I'm saying I'm not denying that they're not black people who act like jerks or people who invest in their own privilege. I'm suggesting, but that has nothing to do with the existence of white supremacy and the privilege, the psychic investment in whiteness that poor people make. I'm simply saying, because I'm not saying all black people are going to be progressive or left-leaning. How else would we explain Condoleezza Rice or Clarence Thomas? I'm suggesting, however, that there's a functional solidarity to be had by joining together the interests of progressive people and poor people of many stripes, races together. But I'm still saying the investment in whiteness in this country is huge. That's why if you read the historian Brundage, who speaks about how whiteness functions even in the South, you can understand again how this plays out. Because look, Joe Louis was a rich black guy, couldn't get into the front door when he was the champion of America, because a poor white person could have privileges he couldn't have. So even at that level, the investment in a certain kind of privilege within black communities who participate in the mainstream of corporate culture has nothing to do with the function of race in American society.
Let me go back to the phones here as we talk and read an email on the way. We're going to go to Linda in Baltimore. Fritz writes in to say, "I'm a white guy who lives in Falston. If people were getting smoked every day where I live, like they are in the city, you could be sure that there would be more than a 1 minute news coverage that city black murders get, and someone would get caught for it. It's so unequal. My brother-in-law got murdered in the wrong part of Baltimore City. Took emergency personnel almost a half an hour to get there because it was on North Avenue, which is, by the way, Michael, a center strip that goes right through the black, east to west through the black community, poor black community. Mm-hmm. He got shot in Roland Park. They would have been there pronto, which is a wealthy white section, and he probably would have lived. This is the same thing happened on a national scale in New Orleans. And Linda in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi,
Linda.
I just sort of want to look at this from another angle. I think I don't disagree with what your guest is saying, but one of the things, as a teacher, I've seen a lot of students, black students particularly, who don't understand that they have options, that they have alternatives, that there are things that they can do for themselves. They feel shut out, that this thing that he's talking about, this dynamic, makes many, particularly the young people that I've seen in the black community, feel that they can't be self-assertive. And I think, you know, when you look at all the poor people that were left in New Orleans, you know, you say, well, they didn't have a car. Well, if I had been one of those people, I would have started calling, I'm white, I would have started calling people and saying, where can I get a car? How do I get out of the city? What do you get, you know, what are you going to give me? Who can I pick up? But I think that a lot of people in the black community say, I have no options. and that's where it ends.
Michael?
Yeah, well, I think that if you take that one way, boy, that's blaming the victim. I mean, in another way, that's an interesting investigation of the psychic consequences of the lack of privilege. Let's take the first verse in terms of blaming the victim. If your 134,000 people in New Orleans didn't have a car, the likelihood is that they didn't know people who had cars either. So the people who are left behind at that last hour trying to get out, you calling somebody with a car, you don't have a car, you don't even have gas money to get gas to get out of the city. So and many of those people were elderly. They had health challenges. So when you began to break down the demographic the demographic identification of the people who were left behind, not only did they not have cars, they had health challenges, they were elderly, they were children, and the like. And so that's a much more complex phenomenon to say that had I been there, I would have started because I'm motivated and assertive, and those people are not assertive. How are you going to say that about 134,000 people? How can you say that about a majority of African-American people that they weren't motivated? I think that would skirt dangerously close to a kind of stereotypical representation of the lack of agency being exercised among African-American people. On the other hand, I think what I was trying to say earlier about one of the functions of white privilege is the ability to believe that anything can be done and that you can do it. That's beautiful. When many African-American people express that, they're called arrogant. They're called full of hubris. When they make a touchdown and they want to celebrate at the end, you're overdoing it. You're hot-dogging it. That's in a sport that they happen to dominate now, that they were previously excluded from. So that the particular styles of African-American assertion are dangerous in American society, are demonized, are scandalously expressed as outrageous, and that are boundary-breaking in negative fashion. So it seems to me that the exercise of agency is critical, that people should take their lives into their own hands, and they come hell or high water, they're going to try to get out. And many African-American people did that. But many people who were left behind, devoid of those resources, don't have even the belief in self or the confidence that their self-belief could translate into the government hearing them. That the whole frustration with many African-American people being incapable of being heard is that we have everything else. We work as hard. We have as much self-assertion, but we don't have the ear of the culture in the same way. And that accounts for some of the disparity in response that we might note.
I think that one of the things, not to put words in Linda's mouth, but that I heard her say, was, I mean, in Baltimore, and I'm sure it's the same across the country, that activists from inner-city poor black neighborhoods have a two-front battle. I think that's part of what she's saying. One battle people take on are the police, the government, industry, to deal with poverty in America and to deal with education and to deal with the overzealousness of police arresting people that shouldn't be arrested on the streets of Baltimore. I mean, that's one level of it. And the other level of it, though, is as Clayton Guyton, who's one of the activists in our East Side of the community, says, we fought for civil rights, now we have to fight for a civil life. And part of that, the other demand, is to get folks in the inner city to be more assertive on their own, for their own welfare, to take charge of their own neighborhoods. I mean, that's, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's
yeah,
because
I don't,
you are
deny
right,
that.
But you are right psychologically. I think people do have that stuff inside their heads because of hundreds of years of what's been going on in this country. But people are trying to say we got to get through that and help people, on the one hand, personally get out of that while you're fighting the social system to change a larger issue that we face.
Well, you heard a lot more than I heard, and I'm sure that's because
maybe I read in too much.
Yeah, that's all right. But you're interpolating with a style and grace and elan. But my point, I ain't bad player. But the point is that you know, you made your point. But I think that what's interesting is that you know what? If a cop stops me, you know, and I get out and I say, "What in the hell are you stopping?" You know what? I can't do that. See, white folk don't understand the privilege you got. I cannot do that. I cannot at any point risk, when I say I can't. Now, I'm using a small example to get to a bigger point here. I'm saying that so many things that white Americans take for granted because the privilege of that cover. Why is it that certain neighborhoods get called on faster? When you call for emergency, they come faster. Well, you know, you can break down statistics and empirical verification of why it is that if I go in that neighborhood, I'm more likely to be hurt and harmed. The bottom line is this, is that you can do a whole bunch of stuff I can't do. And you can do it because you will be protected. Why is it that the disproportionate amount of people who are shot by the police unfairly happen to be African American? Oh, I thought he was reaching for his gun. It was only his wallet. You don't even, if you have that privilege, you have more than what a degree from an Ivy League school can present you. Because you know what you have? You have the presumption of innocence. You have the presumption that you have a right to exist. And I think we're underplaying that here. Now, I'm not denying at all the necessity for self-motivation. Every black leader or intellectual worth his or her salt, has never reneged upon the reality that we must both fight, quote, the outside forces and also the internal demons. I don't know anybody who would deny that. But I'm saying that we have to examine how those factors of race play into the construction of assertion and self-motivation and articulation at the same time.
Well, let me try to go back to the phones here. And Georgia in Towson, you're on the air.
Mark, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I agree with your guest that how you react to other people comes from your own experiences in life, and you're more empathetic towards someone who is like you. That's human nature, whether it's right or whether it's wrong. My question to your guest is, how do we as individuals begin to stop that and to help move forward to do what needs to be done? Because I believe that all races suffer from that malady. So I'll take your answer off the air, and thank you for taking my call.
Michael, we have maybe just a couple minutes left, so I just want to let you know that before you start your answer.
Yeah, let me be very brief. Thank you. Good warning. I think, look, the reality is this, is that, yes, we all suffer from that. Every race suffers from that, but the consequences of every race suffering from that are not equal, right? It's like the storm. The storm was colorblind. It hit every neighborhood. But it didn't affect every neighborhood equally, because if you got money to rebuild, you're in a different situation. If you're in higher ground versus lower ground, you're in a different situation. So true, every race may have that ability. I like people who look like me, and therefore I hang together. But the consequence of Latinos doing that and Vietnamese doing that versus white brothers and sisters doing that is different, because there's a history in America of white supremacy and the predication of governmental resources based upon that skin color and society. There were no Latino, you know, there was black water fountains and white water fountains, and that was their deal in America. Therefore, the difference of that opinion makes a difference. So I think that we all have to challenge ourselves, our internal bigotry, our challenge to systemic oppression, and finding a way to be more humane in the midst of the difficulty. That's what we got to do. If you come out to Politics and Prose, I'm going to speak a little bit more about that and try to drop some more science and at least learn a lot more from you than I can ever hope to impart. But that's the beauty of these book tours. You learn so much from your, like I did from your callers today, because they have so much rich insight and information.
They do. And you also will be, and I don't have the date in front of me, you'll be at Loyola College here.
Yeah, I was there last week, I think.
Last week. You were already here. I'm sorry.
I was already been there and done that, but I love Baltimore, love Loyola, and love this area.
It's good to have you on the air. Thanks so much, Michael. It's always great to talk with you.
Hey, man, it's great always to learn and talk to you.
Take care. Michael Eric Dyson was our guest. His latest book, Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. Right now, we should thank the folks at WAMU and their engineer, Jonathan Cherry, for making that connection from their end possible. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our assistant producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlikhan. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our theme music is by Warren Matthews of Clean Cuts. Please send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. Podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends. Please visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.